Hans Küng was born in Switzerland, was educated at the Gregorian University, where he earned his licentiates in philosophy and theology, and at the Sorbonne, where he wrote a dissertation on Karl Barth that earned him immediate international renown in theological and ecumenical circles, and where he took his doctorate in theology in 1957. He had been ordained a Roman Catholic priest in 1954, and after a few years of parish work, was called to the theology faculty of the University of Münster in 1959. In 1960, he moved to the University of Tübingen, where he has served as professor of fundamental theology, then as professor of dogmatics and ecumenical theology, and since 1980 as professor of ecumenical theology and director of the Institute for Ecumenical Research. In 1962, Father Küng was appointed by Pope John XXIII as one of the periti, or official theological consultants, to the Second Vatican Council. This appointment grew out of his remarkable work on the historical and intellectual structures both of his own church and of other Christian communities. He has continued to seek to clarify the fundamental bases of the Christian faith ever since, sometimes to the displeasure of his ecclesiastical superiors, but always to the stimulation and illumination of those who regard this task as a necessary precondition for progress towards authentic ecumenism. For his subject tonight, he has chosen the question, is there one true religion, or are there many? I'm honored to introduce Professor Küng.
Provost, dear colleagues, dear friends, I am happy to be back in Boston. I think one thing was missed in my biography. I started my, so to speak, American career here in Boston. And when I was invited here the first time, I was remembered that band in Boston is a famous word. Now, I was really celebrated in Boston. It was the time of Colonel Cushing. I have in best remembrances. It was the time when Boston College was able to invite critical theologians. Well, it was a great time, and it opened for me, because this was my first public appearance in the States, this adventure to come here as a young man of, I think I was 34, and to travel then across the country for the renewal of the Catholic Church and for ecumenism. Now, in the meantime, a lot of things changed again. But I am convinced that the present changes, which are in the direction of a conservative church going back to the Middle Ages, that also this is not the end. And that after a certain time, we shall move again. So I tried not to fix myself on all these awkward questions a lot of Catholics have today with the hierarchy, with the Pope, with birth control, with infallibility, and all these questions which are, to a great extent, medieval questions. I think we are moving today to, in the whole world, as a matter of fact, to a new paradigm. It's not just in our days. I think the whole structure, the whole constellation, what is another translation of the word paradigm started to change already with World War I, when the European powers lost the practically already then the exclusive domination on the whole world, and when already it was visible for critical observers, among them many theologians like Karl Barth, like Rudolf Bultmann, like Paul Tillich, who saw that the European world was in a deep crisis and that we were facing practically the collapse of what was called the liberal bourgeois society of Europe already with World War I. And I think what happened then afterwards with World War II, after the periods of Nazism, fascism, and all what we had, was only a confirmation that already, from the point of view of foreign policy, we are moving into post-colonialist, post-imperialist history, constellation, in which we will not anymore have just one or two power centers in Europe, that even the new power centers coming up in the United States on one side and in the Soviet Union on the other side will probably not be the only ones, but that we are moving to a polycentric history, to a polycentric constellation. And it was a fact that all of us in Europe or here in America had to face in a new way the problem of different nations, different continents, and of course also different religions. It's the first time in history that we have not just a dramatic clash between religions, as we had them certainly between Christians and Jews, and especially of course between Christianity and Islam, and then of course also in colonialist forms with other world religions in India and in China and elsewhere in Africa, but that we come to a positive encounter. I know, and when I had to speak the last time about the same topic, it was at the beginning of this year in Windsor Chapel, and Prince Philip, who presided the meeting and made the introduction, said, "Do you really believe that these things, you just come from Rome?" I said, "Yes, but I was late, not because I had troubles with the Vatican, but with British Airways." And British Airways had troubles because there was again bombs announced, and well, they need 2 or 3 hours for that to clear. And it seemed to be adventurous to speak about peace among the religions in such a situation. And I know that a lot of Americans are afraid to travel to Europe because of all that. We are a little smiling at all these things because I think the main problems are not the bombs. And it's certainly true that also bombs cannot answer the questions of bombs. And I think whatever we have experienced now, even with so difficult countries like Libya, show that it is not enough just to throw a few bombs in order to settle the problems and to abolish terrorism. We have more than before. I am deeply convinced, and that is, so to speak, the political background of what I have to say here, you will have no peace among the nations without peace among the religions. And whenever we shall get peace in Northern Ireland or in the Near East, in Lebanon, or between Iraq and Iran, Shiites and Sunnites, or between India and Pakistan, or between Hindus and Sikhs, and you could even go to the Vietnam war and the antagonism between the Christian regime and the Buddhist monks, I do not say that all this is, of course, just a religious affair. But I only would say all these conflicts from Northern Ireland to Asia become so bloody and so passionate if all this has a religious motivation ultimately. Because then people think in the name of God they can kill thousands of others and they can throw bombs, and all this is justified by God himself. So you see, when we are speaking about the problem one true religion or many true religions, we are not just speaking about an academic topic which has no relevance for the present situation. I was invited for the centennial of the American University in Beirut 20 years ago, more or less, with Dr. Fischer Tooft, Secretary General of the World Council of Churches, and Cardinal Willebrands. I think we were five from the Christian side. We had five others from the Muslim side, but they met a week before, and we didn't see them. I asked the foreign minister of this time, Charles Malik, who was the president of this Congress and was, as a matter of fact, the chairman of the United Nations, why didn't we meet? He said, it's too early. I believe today, if we would have seen, if they would have started a dialogue between Christians, Jews and Muslims in Lebanon 20 years ago, they would have avoided a great deal of this bloodshed they had in the meantime. And I know from conversation with the former German Chancellor, who was a good friend of Anwar el-Sadat, the president of Egypt, who was murdered because of his more conciliatory attitude, that a man like Sadat was convinced that you cannot have peace in the Near East without having some kind of understanding between Jews, Muslims and Christians. So you see, that is the background why I find it is important to discuss this question. What is then the value of these religions? And I think it's a very personal problem for everybody. I had, as a matter of fact, already the problem when I was at the Gregorian University, when we had to discuss this famous infallible dogma, outside the church, no salvation. What then about the others? And I think if we see the positions, we have still these problems, and I would not avoid to mention one first position, seeing just four of them, how this question is resolved. I think asking about the question whether there is one true religion or are there many, there is certainly a first position I would have to mention before all the others. There are people who say, you are wrong anyway from the beginning because no religion is true, or all religions are equally untrue. I see Marxists in the audience, but that must not be essentially the position of Marxists. But, well, many Marxists would say it, many scientists would say it. No religion is true. I have not to discuss now things I developed elsewhere. I only would say, if we are speaking about all that, we have to see the horizon that many people are very skeptical about religion, because they say, you are the people who are practically not fostering peace, but you are fostering war. And I think it is important to see that the truth claims were often the origin of all that. I have not to discuss now the issues that to have religion is a good thing. I think if it is a liberating religion, it is a very good thing. If it is a depressing, authoritarian religion, it's a very bad thing. We come back to the criteria. I only say the whole horizon of this issue is, of course, a question of reasonable trust or mistrust. I think there are no rational proofs to prove, as in mathematics or physics, that there is an ultimate reality. On the other hand, I also do not believe that it is just only a feeling whether there is something more than what I can see and calculate and manipulate. It is a question of reasonable trust, and I insist very much on the word trust, but also on the word reasonable, whether you accept or reject a reality, an ultimate reality we call in the Jewish, Christian, Muslim tradition, God. But I know that criticism of Marxists, of psychoanalysis, of very many liberal secularists are very justified, and it depends how religious people are practicing religion, whether these objections are justified in the concrete reality or not. But talking about all that, I think it is good to mention this as the first position. It is the atheistic or agnostic position that all religions are untrue. Now, beside the opposite, you have the second position, people saying only a single religion is true, all the other religions are untrue. And we have the famous definition of the Council of Florence, unhappily just 50 years before the discovery of America, defining the Holy Roman Church, I'm quoting here, Council of Florence, firmly believes, confesses, and proclaims that no one outside the Catholic Church, neither pagan nor Jew, nor unbeliever, or one separated from the Church, will have a part in eternal life, but rather will be condemned to that eternal fire which was prepared for the devil and his angels if he does not before his death join the Catholic Church. Now, I do not know how many are in this room who are damned already. I only can say, fortunately, this position has been changed. As a matter of fact, Boston was a battlefield in this affair, and the older generation will probably remember Father Feeney was his name, here, a student pastor at Harvard, who said, well, if this is defined in an infallible way, we have to stick to it. We cannot then say the opposite. He was condemned because he has taken it literally. I think it would have been honest to say that we changed slowly our position. And finally, Vatican II, fortunately, said exactly the opposite without correcting as such the word, the dogma, outside the Church no salvation. We can change the content, but we should not touch the formula. That is a little our problem. Now, you have the opposite in the Constitution on the Church, 1964, that on the basis of God's all-embracing will and plan of salvation, I quote, those who, through no fault of their own, do not know the gospel of Christ or his Church, but who nevertheless seek God with a sincere heart and moved by grace, try in their actions to do his will as they know it through the dictates of their conscience, those too may achieve eternal salvation. And in the other declaration on the other world religions, it was said, the Catholic Church rejects nothing of what is true and holy in these religions. Now, I think all this changed profoundly the attitude of the Catholic Church in Asia, in Africa, everywhere. And I think it was one of the great statements of the Second Vatican Council. I must say, being critical very often about my own church, that in this case, the Protestant churches are far behind. And the World Council of Churches was not able to declare clearly that there is the possibility of salvation outside Christianity. And I hope they will do it, but they invited, for instance, observers now to Vancouver, the last General Assembly. It was a nice ceremony, but until now, the World Council of Churches because of tensions inside. The whole council was not able to make a positive statement about salvation outside the church and outside Christianity. But I think that is absolutely necessary. It's also not, I think, very consistent to publish guidelines for dialogue with persons of other religions and ideologies, as the World Council has done, if you are not sure whether they go to hell anyway. I think if this is the case, it's not very necessary to have a lot of dialogue with them. They have just to convert. So I think this position has to be changed, and I know that many good theologians in the World Council of Churches would like to change it, but it will not be so easy. You have a third position, that every religion is true, or all religions are equally true. Chacun à sa façon. That seems to be the solution, isn't it? Now, this attitude is mostly a little based on naivety, I would say. People who do not know the different religions say that all these religions are the same. As a matter of fact, it's already a tremendous difference between, I see this as the main difference between the religions of Semitic descendants, in the Semitic tradition, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, prophetic religions, and the Indian religions, Hinduism, all these different religions of Hindu religions, as a matter of fact, and of course, especially Buddhism, Jainism. And then, of course, again, very different the Chinese religion, or religions, Confucianism, Taoism. And I think nobody would just say, well, it's all the same. I believe that the German philosopher Karl Jaspers was very correct when he said you cannot go at the same time the way of Jesus and the way of the Buddha. They are too different. Maybe they converge somewhere, could be, but now to say that every religion is the same, I think is naive. And the famous professor of here in the history of religion, a longtime director of the Institute for World Religions here at Harvard, Wilfred Cantor Smith, and we had long discussions when I was now for a whole semester in Toronto. I think he is perfectly right to say that it is naive to say that all religions are the same, because even the same religion does not remain the same. It's very different, and this is behind what I worked out. I shall not talk about it now, about the paradigm changes we have in the great religions, which are very, very deep and are practically informing everything. So it's just too simple, and it's also too simple because if you say such a thing, you have to affirm that all religions are right and there is nothing wrong with religions. You can then just affirm everything, because religions are true. And everything in the religions is true. And you see, is there then a religion which has no human forms? Or should, for example, all religious statements, all myths and symbols, all revelations and confessions, and finally all rites and customs, authorities and appearances in Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism and Christianity be in an equal manner true and valid? No, the reality of the one experiencing in no way guarantees the reality of that which is experienced. I think there is a difference between sincere religious experiences and pseudo-religious experiences. There is a difference between religion, quasi-religion, and pseudo-religion. If not, you have also to affirm finally Nazism as a kind of true religion. And a lot of people considered it practically as a kind of religion, as Ersatzreligion. So, as everything is not simply one, so also everything is not simply equally valid. Not even in the one and the same religion. And I don't believe that the answer to this absolutism we treated in the third, in the second position, that the answer to that is just relativism to say that everything, it doesn't matter. No, it matters. And it matters especially for those who are involved in these religions. I think no Hindu, for instance, who is interested to have a better Hinduism is very happy if Christians tell him everything in Hinduism is fine, doesn't matter. No, Hindu reformers always said, as Muslim reformers, as Jewish reformers, as Christian reformers, we have to reform our religion. And they didn't say, well, everything is fine. So you see, that's also not the solution. But I also believe that now a fourth, more ingenious solution, that also this one is not, the fourth position is not really the solution for this very, very difficult question, which is, one religion is the true one, or all religions participate in the truth of the one religion. Now, this position seems to avoid absolutism and relativism. They say that is an inclusivist position. Well, but what does now exclusivism mean? You have this in the Indian traditions, where they say in Hinduism or in neo-Hinduism more than in Hinduism, that all empirical religions represent only the various levels, the partial aspects of the one universal truth. The other religions are not untrue, they are simply preliminary. They participate in the universal truth. But of course, every Hindu and every Buddhist would say, well, of course, if you would like to come to the ultimate wisdom, you have to become a Buddhist. You will have your own way, and that's not the problem for salvation for them, but they would say you have only a partial knowledge of what is the truth, and you have to become a Hindu or a Buddhist in order to have the ultimate truth. So you see, this inclusivism is conquering by embracing. And you are not allowed to say, well, but we stay to our own truth and we do not just see that everything is already in your own religion. I think that's also no solution, whether this is done in the Indian way or in the Christian way. My old colleague who died now, the famous Catholic theologian Karl Rahner, had his famous theory of anonymous Christians. I believe that's a little the Catholic version of the Indian type of inclusivism. He said, well, all people who have good intentions, they are embraced by the grace of God, and I would agree on that. But I do not see why you have to say they are then already Christians because of that. They can have best intentions and a very good moral life without being Christians. And just to say, well, if you are a so good guy, you must be a Christian. Maybe not an open Christian, but an anonymous Christian. Then I must say, I never met any Jew, for instance, who was very pleased by this kind of information. And as a matter of fact, if I arrive here in Boston anonymously, I know who I am and the others don't know. But in the case of the anonymous Christians, just the opposite, you know. They do not know what they are, but we know better. So I think also this is not a real solution. We need a solution which gives, well, you see, that's now the problem. the right to your own religious conviction, to be what you are, and nevertheless to be open at the same time for the others. And I think that is the problem. But the presupposition and the starting point, if you go now on to find a positive solution after having had these four different positions, which I do not find really satisfying, I think the starting point has to be no religion just has the monopoly of truth. Also, Christianity has not the monopoly of truth. But at the same time, and that is the dialectical counterpoint, on the other side, nobody has the right to forego a confession of the truth on the ground of an arbitrary pluralism. So I mean, dialogue with the other and witness do not exclude each other. I can be very open for the other religions and at the same time a very committed Christian or Jew or Muslim or Hindu. And it is wrong to say, well, you have to make a choice. No. I would just prefer to be what I am and to say it quite clearly and at the same time to try to understand the others. But just in the meeting before, I was asked about my experiences with people of Khomeini in Tehran, from the family of Khomeini, very high mullahs and ayatollahs. I reflected what I should say as a starting point. And I didn't say I come from a very old university where we have already comparative religion a long time, and we had von Glasenapp and many others. And you know, I really try to be objective. I am a very neutral scientist, scholar. I think this believing Muslims would have thought, this is one of these Europeans who do not believe in anything anyway. Why to talk to him? It was not a question of tactics or strategy, but it was for me a conviction that I said, you know, I'm very grateful for this invitation. And you know, I come here as a Christian theologian who is convinced of the Christian faith, as you are convinced of the Muslim faith. But I come at the same time with an open heart and an open mind, and I would like to understand more about Islam and about the possibility of a dialogue between these two great religions. And I saw that these Muslims were immediately, they agreed, and they slowly, slowly found confidence that you are not just being a traitor of your own religion, that you are not just a politician, but that you are serious about questions of truth. So it is not exclusive, but of course, we have to presuppose at the same time, if we have no monopoly of truth, that the borders between truth and untruth run not just between Islam and Christianity, to take this example, but run through Christianity and Islam at the same time. And if we are honest, we would say that the borders between truth and untruth run through each of us, run through our own heart. Quite often we see that we were not really perfectly true, that we made mistakes, that we were on the wrong track. And I think that is valid also for all these great religions. And if somebody says, well, but Christianity nevertheless is the religion of peace, of love, well, talk to these people what they tell you. Christianity in Asia, Christianity in the Near East has the image of being not at all a religion of love. We are considered as extremely aggressive, exclusive, intolerant. They say we are inwardly split, in comparison with Indian religions. They say a lot of things. They even say you do not even understand Jesus yourself. You made him a god very up in the highest, but you do not follow him. Ask Gandhi what he said. Who is the god of the Christian? The money? And all the rest. I have not to insist on that. I only say, when we have the approach that, well, the others are, of course, here in a difficult situation, but we are, our religion is basically the true one because we have this high principles. Well, it's not only a question of theory. It's a question of practice too. And if you have to ask yourself, who is for you a good Jew? You are not just thinking about his confession of faith. You would see how he behaves. So Christians cannot be offended if others are also asking how we behave. And so the discussion between, the question of a true religion is not only the question of truth, but it's also a question whether a religion is good, whether a religious person is at the same time true and good. And the distinction between the verum and the bonum are abstract distinctions. If you are asking who is a true Christian, you would also say, well, the true Christian or the true Buddhist, it's the same, is the good Christian and the good Buddhist. So it is at the same time a question of the good and the bad religion, and it's a question of theory and praxis. And so you see, it is not so easy now to find criteria. And when we had this dialogue in Tübingen about these three religions, Islam, Hinduism and Buddhism, I felt myself all the time that whenever we came very near to the questions of criteria, also my partners in dialogue became extremely nervous. Because in comparative religion, they don't like the question of truth. They compare. And they say, we do not judge. Well, we do not want to judge. But in our own religion, we have also to make some judgment what is good and what is bad and what is true and what is untrue or false. But the question of criteria is very difficult for comparative religion because they would say where we are mostly descriptive, we are not making judgments. And for theology, it is difficult because most theologians have no knowledge about these religions. And those who make judgments generally know nothing about them. And you cannot make just judgments in abstracto. You need a great deal of information. You need to read books about all these religions. You need to meet persons. You need a great deal of traveling if you would really like to talk about all these religions. So, you see, we need criteria. But, of course, we need criteria. If we would say the opposite, I come back to this point because it's so decisive, that because it is religious, it's already justified. Well, are the burning of widows justified because it's made out of religious motives? Does prostitution become a sacred thing because it's made in the temple? Is to burn a person very good because it's made in the name of the Holy Trinity? Can you burn people physically or today psychologically because we have the truth and we know everything about birth control and we can condemn Catholic professors in Catholic schools because we have the truth? What about all that? Is all this because the people who make all the things have good intentions and are obviously very religious persons? Is all this already then okay? I would say no. And you see, here, just to say, well, how will you then give an answer to the question, what is now good and what is bad? It is also not so easy to say, well, look at the Bible. This can be said in questions between Catholics and Protestants, because the Bible is the common foundation. But it's already much more difficult with the Jewish people, because we have only the Hebrew Bible, what we call the Old Testament, in common. It's already rather difficult with the Muslims, who say our revelation is the Quran, and don't quote the Bible, because the Bible can only say what is already in the Quran. And of course, with the Asian religions, even more difficult. In this situation, I thought we should not give up, of course, as Christians, what the Bible tells us. And having read and written a great deal about what does it mean to be a Christian and all that, I thought it would be interesting not to give up what I have written. I would still agree with everything. I didn't change my mind in these basic Christian positions. Nevertheless, I think another approach is necessary. And so I would distinguish today three sets of criteria which have to be distinguished in order to have a progress in dialogue. And I would call the first set of criteria what I would call the ethical, the generally ethical criteria. The generally ethical criteria based on what is human, or what is truly human, or what is humane. And you see here, I feel with many who call themselves humanists, I think there is too much truth in all that. And I think it's also basically a very Christian thing that we have to see what is human. And I think there is no Christian ethics which would not insist that we have to behave in a human way, in a truly human way, or in a humane way. And I think even if it is very difficult to say what is humane, there are nevertheless clear examples I just mentioned, which are considered as inhuman. To kill persons out of religious motives is today certainly considered as not humane and not truly human. And even if this is, of course, bound to a historical development, even if we today have different opinions what is human or humane, truly human, as in the Middle Ages, we have a development in humanity of standards which are often not observed, but which are nevertheless the increasing consensus in humanity. And one of the great things in the history of this century was certainly that after having had two world wars, the United Nations, who were often a failure, were nevertheless a success to have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaimed in after World War II. And I think this declaration of 1948 is only an indication of what on the moral level is already the conviction of most religions. And it is quite obvious that there is a progress in all the religions in this field. One thinks, for example, of the elimination of the evil practice of the Inquisition's use of fire and torture, which lasted within Roman Catholicism well into the modern period, last century. Or think about the humane new interpretation of the concept of jihad, of holy war in Islam, to take it as an ethical demand, not as a political aggression. Or if you think about the elimination of human sacrifice in India, in Hinduism, the burning of widows, even if this still happened just this year, Nevertheless, most Hindus would say, no, that's not good. And it is quite clear that, for instance, in Arab countries, there is a great discussion going on human rights. And they see that this is a problem for the Quran and, of course, for the Sharia, the Muslim law. And I had just a long conversation with a lawyer from Sudan who said it is quite obvious that we are in contradiction with the Human Rights Declaration in 2 points, seen from the Quran, in the question of women and in the question of non-believers, where we have to correct ourselves. So you see, I would say as a criteria, now formulating in a very sober way, that the humanum is a very fundamental ethical criteria for all the religions. Its rights and institutions fosters human beings in their human identity, meaningfulness and value, and helps them gain a meaningful and fruitful life. It is a true and good religion. That means whatever clearly protects, heals, and fulfills human beings in their physical, psychic, individual, social humanity, in their life, integrity, freedom, justice, and peace, whatever therefore is truly human, what is humane, can with reason call itself divine, with reason. But formulated in a negative way, insofar as a religion spreads inhumanness, insofar as in its dogmas and moral doctrines, its rights and institutions hinders human beings in their human identity, meaningfulness and value, and thus help them fail in gaining a meaningful and fruitful existence, it is a false and a bad religion. That means whatever clearly suppresses, injures, and destroys human beings in their physical, psychic, individual, social humanity, in their life, integrity, freedom, justice, and peace, whatever therefore is inhumane, not truly human, cannot with reason call itself divine. I know there are a lot of ambivalent cases, but you know yourself that there are very clear cases where everybody would say that is really not human, or where they would say that is truly human. So you see, that is, I think, the general criteria which has to be applied to all the religions. The other two sets are easier to understand, and I shall only be very briefly about these other two. I think every religion can be asked about their own religious criterion, that means their own constitution. And I would say the authentic or canonical is a general religious criterion. You can always challenge, well, let us say first a Christian. Often the others are challenging us. They say, you appeal to the Bible, you appeal to Christ, and behave thus. The Bible, especially the New Testament, serves Christianity as its canon, as its normative measure. And I think you can also challenge a Jewish person with regard to the Torah if somebody does not follow it. And I think the same is true for the Quran for Muslims. And I think it is not only the question of books, it's also the question of the leading figures who are incorporating the message, Jesus Christ, the Prophet Muhammad, the Buddha. All these are authorities of these religions, and it is in dialogue justified to ask, how can you behave in such a way as Buddhists if the Buddha says this? I think that's another set of criteria I have not to develop here. But I think it is quite clear that we have to look at our origin and whether we are really truly Christians, whether we are truly Jews, whether we are truly Muslims, looking from our own origin, looking from the essence, from the nature of our own religion. And I think it's an essential question for every religion in this turmoil of our times that we keep our identity in this great paradigm change from the modern times to the postmodern times, or from the Middle Ages even to the postmodern times, sometimes in Islam and Roman Catholicism. So this is a criteria, and another set of criteria, I think, which is of greatest importance. Now, of course, there is then the specifically Christian criterion, which is only has to be applied only in a very secondary way to other religions. We have to ask ourselves first when we are saying, well, is there one true religion or are there many? I think a Christian has to see whether he is truly Christian himself and has not to judge the others from the Christian standpoint. And what it means to be a Christian, I think I have not to explain it a long time, having written a small book about that. I think basically it's very simple. It's not who says, Lord, Lord. It's not who says, Christ, Christ, or Son of God, Son of God, but who follows him and tries as good as he or she can to realize in his or her own way his message. That is, I think, the criterion for a Christian. But you see, that we have to apply to ourselves. And that is where we really can always see how far our own religion is true or not true, false or not true or untrue. You see, now when we have the three sets of criteria, we can come slowly to the answer of the main question. Are there now many true religions, or is there one true religion? Now, I think this question cannot be answered if we are not having at the same time two perspectives. And I think all the answers were often unsatisfying because we observed only one perspective and not the other at the same time, what seems to be difficult, but it is possible. You can see all the religions, you can also see Christianity as every religion from the outside, completely, so to speak, as a neutral observer, as a historian of religion. That's very justified. You can consider Christianity as a non-Christian or as a former Christian. I mean, without any special commitment to the Christian message, tradition, or community. Then, of course, Christianity finds itself as one of the world religions and must satisfy the various general ethical and religious criteria of truth I just mentioned. And you see, from the outside, in this perspective, we shall find many true religions. But there is, of course, at the same time, with his consideration from the outside, so to speak, from the perspective of foreign policy, this does not exclude another internal perspective for my own domestic policy, for myself. And I think for the individual person, it is perfectly honest and sincere to integrate both perspectives. And if somebody says, how can you be sincere if you believe it a different way from the outside and the inside? I say, well, that is no contradiction. You have the same phenomenon in other fields too. When, for instance, an international lawyer compares, as a scholar, various national constitutions with one another, or when he attempts to arrive at an understanding in a specifically disputed point, for instance, in international negotiations, he likewise views his national constitution and his country from outside. However, he views the same constitution and his country from within when, as a loyal citizen among citizens, he feels himself obliged precisely to this constitution and holds himself bound to it in conscience. We are not one-dimensional beings. And I think the best negotiators in politics are those who are able to understand the other constitutions, the other nations, and the other mentalities, as well as our own, and can argue from their own standpoint, and nevertheless be at the same time very loyal to your own position. I do not think that an American diplomat or an American negotiator would be a traitor of his country when he understands very well what, for instance, the Soviet Union and these people have in mind and what are their justified interests. And I think if we shall ever have some treaty, it is only possible if you have negotiators from both sides who are able to understand the others. And if I am going to Muslim countries talking about Christianity and Islam, I just have to acknowledge that also they are true religions. But from within, of course, Christianity remains for me the true religion. And I do not hide that. I say to the others, as I said already, and I think my religion is then not only one religion among the others, but for me, Christianity is my faith. And I am presupposing that also my Muslim partner in dialogue thinks the same thing. Only if we are agreeing that also the other has a right to think that he has the true religion, we are able to have this kind of dialogue. And I do not believe in these models of dialogue of some people, especially here in the States, who think that we can just go on a high mountain, you know, some very educated intellectuals and professors of religion who see all these religions and who know that they have only partial truth. And then they are making their judgments and they say it's ultimately one mystical experience. I don't think that this would help us to bring the people together. Because up there on this mountain, only a few intellectuals would be who are debating among themselves and have a nice agreement, but all the other people are still, you know, in the valleys, and they remain in their own valley. So I think whenever you are presupposing that the others have to give up their own faith in order to have serious dialogue, I think it's useless. So, you see, these are the two perspectives which are, I think, the ultimate, which is our basic attitude, and these two perspectives can easily come together. I do not want to elaborate this more. I think all this is also very well founded in this figure, which remains for Christians the leading figure, this Jesus who is for us not just one of the prophets, but who is for us the Christ. I think if he would come again, I think he would apply what he had to say already in the Sermon on the Mount, in his parables, and I think he would apply all that to the people of other religions, as he has done to the Samaritans, who were much worse than pagans for Jewish people, as it applied it to the Roman centurio. And I think he would ask from us today a solidarity of fellow humanity, which has to be entirely concrete, which not only foregoes religious wars, persecutions and inquisition, and practices religious tolerance, but also in its relationship to the other religion substitutes for its collective egoism, ecclesial centrism, with philanthropy, with a solidarity of love, which therefore, instead of reckoning the history of guilt among the religions, practices forgiveness And there's a new beginning, which does not simply eliminate those often humanly divisive religious institutions and constitutions, but nevertheless relativizes these institutions for the welfare of humanity, which instead of overt or covert power struggles among the religious political systems, strives for successive reconciliation. No uniform religion for the entire world, but peace among the religions, as a prerequisite, as I said at the beginning, for peace among the nations. We have to fight for unity among the Christian churches. There will be not just a unity between the different religions, they are too different. But what we need is peace. And for that, I may say, in order to come to an end of this very large topic, I think I have to mention a last perspective, which is, I think, basic for the evaluation of the other religions and our own, and which we are often forgetting, even if it is, I think, very, very Christian. For me, as a believer, for us, as a believing community, Christianity, insofar as it bears witness to God in Christ, is to be sure the true religion. But we do not believe in Christianity. We believe in God Himself, who revealed for us as Christians Himself in Christ. And we know that even Christianity has not the whole truth. God alone has the whole truth. Only God Himself, however named, is the truth. And you see, that is the third dimension, which is not the external dimension, not the internal dimension, but which is, so to speak, the vertical dimension. And so, in all that, my final remarks would be the following. Even Christians cannot claim to have comprehended Him, the uncomprehendable, to have grasped Him, the ineffable, unfathomable. Even in Christian faith, we perceive with Paul the truth itself, which is God, only as in a mirror, in puzzle-like outline, piecemeal, in single facets, dependent at every time on our extremely specific standpoint and age. Yes, even Christianity is in via, on the way, ecclesia peregrinans, pilgrim church, homines viatores, human beings going their way. And we know today more than ever that we are not alone on the way, but that we are together with hundreds of millions of other human beings from all possible confessions and religions who are going along their own way. However, with them, we are in a process of communication, which the longer it lasts, the deeper it becomes, wherein one should not dispute about what is mine and yours, my truth, your truth, but wherein one should much more be infinitely open to learning, to taking up the truth of the others, and without jealousy sharing one's truth. But now at the end, certainly some will ask me, where will all that lead? I would answer, history is open-ended, and likewise interreligious dialogue, which other than interconfessional dialogue has just begun, is open-ended. What the future will bring to the Christian religion which for me is, as I said, the true religion, we do not know. And what the future will bring the other, the non-Christian religions, we do not know. How Christology, how Quranology, how Buddhology, or how indeed the church, the Ummah, the Muslim Ummah, the Buddhist Sangha, will be in the year 2086. How they will look, who knows that? What is certain about the future is only one thing. At the end of our own human life, as well at the end of the history of the human race, there will be no Buddhism or Hinduism, also no Islam and no Judaism. Indeed, at the end, there will be also no Christianity. At the end, there will be no religion whatsoever, but rather there will be the one unutterable itself, toward which all religions are directed, whom the Christians also, when the incomplete has given way to the complete, will know in fullness as they themselves are known. The truth, face to face, at the end, not now. Thus, at the end, there will not any longer stand a prophet between the religions, or an enlightened one. There will stand no Muhammad, nor Gautama. Indeed, even Jesus the Christ, in whom Christians believe, will not anymore stand between the religions, but according to St. Paul in the Epistle to the Corinthians, at the end, he, Jesus Christ, to whom all powers are subordinate, even death, as he said, will subordinate himself to God, so that God, Hotheos, the Father, the God, or however one may name him in the East, that God himself truly will be not only in all, as God is already now, but at the end, God will be all in all. And so you see, that is the final dimension. And the word of St. Augustine comes to my mind when I speak about that, who ends his big work, De Civitate Dei, with this beautiful word that et tunc vacabimus et videbimus, videbimus et amabibus, amabibus et laudabimus, et hoc erit in fine sine fine. And then we shall be free, and we shall love. And we shall love, and we shall praise. And this will be at the end without end. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Kuhn. To introduce Professor Leroy Rauner to a Boston University audience, is probably as unnecessary as introducing Professor Kuhn to any audience interested in theological matters. Professor Rauner is, as I'm sure all of you know, director of the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and in that capacity he is the organizer of the splendid series of lectures of which tonight's event is a part. He is also a distinguished student of philosophical theology, with a special interest in the connections between Buddhist and Christian thought and culture, and is at work on a critical study of contemporary Christian views on the relationship between Christianity and other world religions. In that capacity, he will comment on Professor Kuhn's paper. Professor Rauner?
I have a 2-minute presentation, a 1-minute announcement, and a 7-minute comment. The presentation. Jim Langford is the editor of the University of Notre Dame Press, which has published a number of Boston University authors, Alistair McIntyre, Tom McCarthy, Elie Wiesel, Herbert Mason, and is the publisher of our annual series, Boston University Studies in Philosophy and Religion. Jim is a former Dominican priest who has since turned to some worldly pursuits. His two most recent books are the result of his passion as a Cubs fan. One is called The Game Is Never Over Till the Last Man Is Out, An Affectionate History of the Chicago Cubs. And the second is A Theology of Suffering entitled A Cub Fan's Guide to Life. As a Dominican, Jim wrote what is still, I'm told, one of the definitive books on the trial of Galileo. It is called Galileo, Science, and the Church. I visited with him last weekend. I should tell you that the University of Notre Dame Press also publishes most of the work of Charles Curran, who is now under some criticism from the Vatican. And when I told Jim that Hans Kuhn was to be here this evening, he asked me if I would present him a copy of his book on Galileo, which I had intended to do in private, but seemed more appropriate to do publicly tonight. And I'm going to read you the inscription. To Hans Kuhn, who knows the eschatological hope that we can outlive the Grand Inquisitor, even in his reincarnations. Thank you for what you have done for Christianity and the Church. Jim Langford. My announcement is of a new book which was sent overnight express from Doubleday by Hans Kuhn and colleagues at Tübingen on Christianity and the World Religions, Paths to Dialogue with Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, which has just been published. This is the second night in a row in which I have been responsible for replying to a lecture which I have not previously read. Last night was tough. The lecturer was introduced by his full title, and I read it to you from the program. His Grace, the Most Reverend and Right Honorable Robert Alexander Kennedy Runcie D.D. Oxon, Archbishop of Canterbury and Primate of all England. What do you say in response to something like that? Sorry, primate, you're wrong. Sort of like saying, sorry, Pope, you're wrong. Although I understand that there are people who do that from time to time. Anyway, mean, I feel a little bit like the young preacher who decided that he was not going to prepare a text but let God speak to him at the time of the sermon, and who in church on Sunday, during the hymn before the sermon, still had not heard God speak. So he knelt in passionate prayer. He was a Methodist, and said, "Oh God, speak to me." And finally, God spoke. And God said, "Brother, you're not prepared." But actually, that's not entirely true, because in the tradition of our Institute critics, once I saw the topic, I knew what I wanted to say about it. I didn't have to wait to hear the paper anyway, so I have prepared my comments in advance. The question, "Is there one true religion or are there many?" seems to me to be confusing. Religions, I suggest, are not operationally true or false. Religions as such are only good or bad. A religion is, after all, a conglomerate of beliefs, customs, rituals, practices, all of which change over a period of time and not all of which are consistent with one another. Yeah. Christian Unitarians, for example, are closer to Hindus than they are to Roman Catholic or Greek Orthodox Christians. The conglomerate is so diverse, and the people in it celebrate so many different persuasions, that it is hard to know what it would mean to say that a religion, as a religion, is true. Metaphysically, religions are not refined enough to be either true or false. I suggest that they are only sociologically valuable as either good or evil. But the truth question is, of course, a critical question in interreligious dialogue. Religions make truth claims, and it is the contest among these truth claims which most engages us. Mahatma Gandhi used to say, "All religions are true, more or less." When I first heard that, I thought it was the dumbest thing anybody had ever said on the topic. Now, however, I think it makes an important point. Religions as cultural conglomerates also understand themselves in terms of certain fundamental affirmations. Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet, or Atman and Brahman are one, or Jesus Christ is Lord. The problem with religious truth statements is to separate out the inane, the irrelevant, and the dysfunctional, all of which may be true. Separate those out from statements which speak to our metaphysical condition and become the substance of our religious life. But even these are graded. Some affirmations are more important than others, and in each tradition, there is, I suspect, at least one statement which becomes definitive. So the critical question in interreligious dialogue is not whether one religion is more true than another. The question is whether one particular affirmation belonging to one religious community may be definitive for all religious traditions, or whether we are in a pluralistic situation which makes all religious affirmations co-equal. My view is that many religious affirmations are indeed co-equal, but that only one religious affirmation can be definitive. The co-equal statements seem to me to exist on two levels. There's a basic ground level of religious affirmation, often associated with a perennial philosophy, which simply recognizes a mysterious realm of transcendence, brooding over and impregnating our experience of ourselves, other selves, and the natural world. That, I take it, is the bottom line in anything that has ever been called religion. The names for the transcendent vary, but if all you know is the ordinary, you have no religion. In that sense, there is already a common religion of humankind. On this first level, all religions are indeed the same, and they're all true. There is a transcendent. Any religious believer recognizes in the inarticulate piety of any other religious believer this reality, from the most sophisticated theologian to the most primitive animist. Then there are second-level affirmations, which in the major world religions may be more common than we had thought. This is one of the fun things about interreligious dialogue these days. There are a number of fascinating problems surfacing in this conversation. A Christian Platonist like Augustine and a Hindu Advaitin like Shankara are very close in their understanding of how the self is related to God. Augustine's notion of the imago Dei, that inner, hidden, metaphysically definitive self of the Christian, is very hard to distinguish from Shankara's notion of the Atman, that inner, hidden, metaphysically definitive self of the Hindu Advaitin. But many of these second-level affirmations are in conflict and are subject to changing interpretation as a result of changing social and cultural conditions. One of my favorite illustrations of this is an interchange I had with my friend Tai Uno, who's a Buddhist priest who teaches at Smith College. And we were talking about human rights. And I said, Tai, I don't understand how you fellows can have a notion of human rights because you don't have any notion of a self to contain human rights. And he got very exercised and he said, of course I believe in human rights. I'm an American. Now, all sorts of things are, we tend to think of religions in a textbook sense, in a theoretical sense. What we are talking about here is living religion. And there are all sorts of forces interacting and interchanging in the constant reconception, as my teacher Ernest Hocking would say, of each of our religious traditions. This rapid change in critical religious affirmations is nowhere more evident than in Protestant Christianity. Late 18th and early 19th century Protestant theology centered on the hope of heaven and the fear of hell. But it is hard work to find a 20th century Protestant theologian who has had much to say about either one. This makes it difficult to focus on those definitive truth affirmations which make the real metaphysical difference among religious communities. A number of contemporary philosophical theologians have proposed a pluralistic notion of ultimate truth as a way of avoiding exclusivism. Since I don't have time to be polite, let me say that this is the Hindu mystical position. I think it's wrong because there are religious issues in this life on which we must take a stand. Curiously enough, we have no qualms about being exclusivistic on ethical issues. Those of us who believe in human rights, for example, are not about to include apartheid or terrorism or torture or repressive dictatorship in some seductively unselective ethical pluralism. Nor should we. Choose ye this day whom ye shall serve. And metaphysics also makes a difference. A pantheistic cosmology, for example, leads inevitably to a Stoic ethic because a pantheistic world has only inner relations. There's no outside to anything, so the only ethical resources we have are inner. So it's at this primary level that the religious truth question is joined, and where people have to make critical decisions. There is some confusion, however, about which issues are primary, and interreligious dialogue is beginning to sort some of these things out. For example, many have taken the quintessential Christian statement to be the affirmation that Jesus Christ is Lord. This, I feel, is a kind of Christomonism and strikes me as uncharacteristic standing alone of the history of Christian thought. I would argue that the definitive Christian truth claim is the Trinitarian conception of God. A final word about the possibility of many true religions. The major world religions will surely continue. I cannot believe that God wants a world without Hindu temples or reverence for the Tao. The 19th century Christian missionary enterprise was surely wrong in thinking that it could replace other world religions. What Christianity has done, rather, and here I venture a little beyond what Professor Kung had to say this evening, is to affect these other world religious traditions from within, as with the rise of Neo-Hinduism in India, which could equally well be called the rise of Neo-Christianity. Historically speaking, I believe that the truth will out. This transcendent realm, which all religions instinctively accept, is not just the holy world power who created the universe, and not simply the great prophetic figures in Jesus who inspired a great religious tradition, and not simply that mysteriously enabling presence which from day to day leads us all into new truth. It is all of these diverse but unified powers, presences, and persons. And this seems to me to be the truth which defines all other religious truths.